Once again, I would like to say how much pleasure it gives me to be here with you on these two occasions. In this second and last lecture, I shall present a concept of a relationship between the church and the world. The relationship I propose is one of dialogue. The dialogue between the church and the world must first go on in the church member, filling him with tension. This is not acceptable. We do not like tension. If the church member knows any peace, it will be a strange kind, known as the peace of God. Only a few seem to be able to sustain that kind of tension and endure that kind of peace, but those who do are found on God's frontiers in the world. I might ask, are you up to it? Let's see. The Lady Bountiful role of the church is over. We can no longer expect to dispense our treasures according to our understanding of the world's need. We must now train ourselves to hear the voice of the Lord in the events of contemporary life, through our poverty in relation to our abundance, through our social upheavals and demands for more maturity in human relations, through our awe-inspiring discoveries and inventions of human enterprise, God is speaking to, guiding, shaking up a complacent and sometimes obsolete church. Let us remember, though, that God seeks also to speak to the world through the church. But the relation must be one of dialogue, of no advantage to either side, and of common action. Churchmen are heard to complain, though, that men are not interested in the church. And we can reply, why should they be if the church is not honestly interested in them? Much of the contemporary church is concerned about the questions and problems of the form of its life. Some are saying that the present forms, especially those of the residential church, are obsolete. They urge the searching out of new forms. Each side, the radical and the conservative churchmen, succeed in making the other side defensive and drive each other to extreme points of view that perhaps neither would hold if left alone. Every institutional form of the church will inevitably lag behind and betray the redemptive purposes of Christ. But this is not a reason for abandoning the institutional expressions of Christianity. The witness of the church need not be limited by its institutional form. Life is always breaking out of the forms it creates for itself, and in breaking out of them may break those who resist the new, and even those who call for reform and new form. The problems of forms of life cannot be settled by a preferential choice between old and new forms. Forms are the creation of life. Life always expresses itself in some form, and every form gives evidence of the life that produced it. The form continues expressive and relevant to the extent that it is obedient to the life that gave it birth. The Spirit produced the church, and as long as the church is open to the life around it, it will remain alive, responsible, and relevant. But let it become concerned about itself, its size, its success, or its buildings, or its programs, and it becomes dead, irresponsible, and irrelevant. The relation between form and vitality must always be one of tension. But tension for most people is intolerable. They protect themselves by eliminating the tension, either by substituting form for reality or by claiming to serve the Spirit without form. The pain of being open to the Spirit and vitality is obvious. There is the fear that the form we have will be lost, and we will not find the new form by which we may live. This is a risk we have to make. This is the risk of creativity, a risk that many churchmen are not able to make. The form of religion becomes, therefore, a substitute for the God they profess to worship. The practical question is, how can the present form of church life be brought again into creative tension with the spirit that brought it into being in the first place? If that creative tension could be restored, there would occur reformation, transformation, and new formation of the church's relationships. Such a result depends upon the existence of dialogue between church form and its generating and rejuvenating life, because dialogue restores the creative tension between life and its forms. We have said that the Spirit is at work in the world, and that through contemporary life, God speaks to and acts upon the church. It would seem then that the church must offer itself in dialogue with the world and with God, who is seeking to judge, purify, and transform his church. The inclination of many in the church will be against dialogue because they make egocentric use of church life to maintain a world and religion of their own creation. Insistence on dialogue may well alienate them, but such winnowings are necessary for the health of the body of Christ. Such dialogue will bring us all again to the point where we will have to determine whether we will say yes to Christ or no. Both in the church and the world would be in better condition if we helped each other say either a responsible yes or no, and thus eliminate the confusions and ambiguities resulting from our various irresponsible responses. I shall now make use of some diagrams to assist in the discussion of the dialogue between the church and the world. In figure one, you see a circle representing the world, in which there are smaller circles containing crosses. That tells you that they represent churches. There is nothing else in the world except these churches. Each circle has arrows pointing into its center. These represent the introspective nature of church life, of some church life. Here we have a church religious view of the world. Anything else that might exist in the world has no meaning for the parish or religion, except possibly as a source of sin, and the place where we work and make a living. Often from a religious or church point of view, people may not even recognize the existence of the world and its meaning. Please notice that these circles have names in them representing denominations. Of course, there are a great many other denominations than those represented, and as you may observe, I put Lutherans on top. When these churches assemble in their ingrown gatheredness, they are a divided church, and this they do when they assemble. Most of the church's worship occurs when the churches are separated from each other. The worship of God, therefore, is marked by the sin of its brokenness, especially is this true in its observance of the Lord's Supper. He gave his disciples commandment to break his bread and drink his cup in remembrance of him. But this is something that Christian brothers cannot do together, even after many hundreds of years. If we cannot have communion with each other, how can we hope to have dialogue with the world? We should also observe in figure one that the church in the circles is gathered there only 2 or 3 hours a week, usually on Sundays. If that is the prevailing and working concept of the church, it is a limited one and can make little impact on the life around it. In this exclusively church world, attempts are made to unite churches. As, for instance, bringing the Presbyterians and the Lutherans together. This is called an effort toward unity. The efforts are not too productive because they have to be based on attempts to reconcile and compromise differences. What is needed is something outside of the denominations that will focus their resources, many of which they have in common, such as the Bible, prayer, so on, so that they can be reunited by a reunifying devotion to a purpose outside of themselves. What is needed is the focus on the world for which Christ lived and died, and to which he sent his church to be a continuing agent of his love. In figure two, we see a more complete view of the world. Not only do we have churches, but now other activities of men are represented. There is the home and the family, which thus far has received most of the attention from the church. Then there is business and industry and scientific research. Scientific research and discovery, education and welfare, although in this diagram it isn't there, but you could read it in there. The performing and plastic arts, government and military organizations, and so on. And now the church does not seem to be so central, and now church people cannot be so sure of themselves. Now when church people look out on this world, they often experience a sense of intimidation because these other worldly enterprises are important and wield such tremendous power. But many church people justify themselves by regarding them as secular and worldly, and therefore not to be taken as seriously as the church. And yet they realize that the church does not have the influence it should. Then they comfort themselves by reasoning that men let their worldly concerns blind them to spiritual concerns. And so goes the self-justifying church-centered mind. If we look again at the diagram, we will see crosses in each of the squares like the crosses in the circles. These men, as we have seen, that God is in, these mean, as we have seen, that God is in the world and in these human enterprises as well as in the church. This does not mean that there is no difference between a business or a school and a church as organizations and institutions, but it does mean that God is in both of, and so are church members. The church therefore exists in two spheres or ways, as a gathering of people who acknowledge the lordship of Christ and their loyalty to him, and as the people of Christ expressing their loyalty to him by engaging in the work of the world through the existing forms for the doing of that work. Our present difficulty is that there is not an adequate working relation between the circles and the squares, between the church and the world, except in the case of the square marked home and family. To this area of life, the church is closely related, and to it has directed most of its ministry. Thank you. Otherwise, the churches are identified with neighborhoods where men sleep and are with their family, which in this day occupies less and less of their time. The church's ministry can no longer be directed only to the private spheres of men's life and must include also the public sphere where most of their time is spent, to which they are committed and where they find their values and meanings. This relation between the church as a community of faith and worship and the church devoted to the work and life of the world should be, as we have seen, one of dialogue. In figure 3, we see this dialogue expressed by the double-headed arrows. Only a few arrows are drawn in order to keep the diagram simpler. But the same arrow should be drawn between all the churches and all the world's enterprises. Immediately, we should observe that the flow of persons and meanings is two-way, from the world to the church, as well as from the church to the world. I once had a conversation with a man who, in response to the question, "Where is your church?" said, "On the corner of 4th and Main." When I asked where his church was when it wasn't there, he at first showed his surprise until he understood, and then realized that his church at the time we were flying between New York and Detroit was literally all over the world. We can think of the church as church people from all the different churches moving on Monday, like a vast army into all the enterprises of the world. In order to make our thinking more definite, let us think of all the church people at their work from Monday morning to Friday or Saturday. And what is one of your major industries here?
Shoes and beer.
Well, what's the name of one of the companies?
Brown Shoe Company.
What? Brown Shoe Company. In order to make our thinking more definite, let us think of all the church people at their work from Monday morning to Friday or Saturday at the Brown Shoe Company. Two truths strike us about this gathering of church people. It is a gathering of church people. First, they are a vast group of church men and women who spend more time at the Brown Shoe Company than they do in church, thank God. And second, they are denominationally unidentifiable and mixed so that a Baptist cannot be distinguished from a Presbyterian or a Methodist from a Lutheran. I don't know how you feel about that. The weakness in this picture is that they do not have an image of themselves as the church in the Brown Shoe Company, or in the world anywhere. Their identities as being church are in church. Unfortunately, in most opinion, they are the church only when they are in the church. At least we can say that the ecumenical church is potentially present in the Brown Shoe Company. The church that is united in a common endeavor, and a church that is serving the world. The serving the world part, of course, is central. Now we get a picture of the ecumenical and we see it, watch my pencil, you see that it includes the world. That is ecumenical. Where the circle would only include churches, that would be church unity. But ecumenical has to do with the concentration of churches on some responsibility in the world, and as they address themselves to that responsibility, they discover their relation to each other and their unity. The purpose of the movement of church people into the world is not to do the same things they do in church, but to do their work in the world. Loyalty to Christ is expressed not only by preaching about him and holding services of worship and studying Christian doctrine, but by taking the world seriously, by doing our jobs efficiently, by living the love of Christ in our relationships with all people, and by supporting action that seeks to correct the ills and injustices of the structures in which men live. If the ideal of the ecumenical church is to be realized, it will be necessary for the churches, as they are now constituted, to change their programs so that the members will acquire this in-the-world image of themselves as the church. I choose to focus our discussion on the present form of the local church because we should explore its possibilities for relevance when reorganized for a dialogical relationship with the world. Of course, the church must find new ways to respond to and participate in industrial and urban life outside of the present forms, but they are not yet clear. This is a time for experimentation and expectation. In the meantime, we have the residential forms of the church, which may be able to provide programs and structures through which men may learn to relate the meanings of their lives to the meaning of their faith and act responsibly. How may we help church people have this second or dispersed image of themselves as a church? Well, here's one suggestion. Each church could make an inventory of where its members spend most of their time in their most important activity from Sunday to Sunday. I have discovered that many clergy, for instance, do not know where their people work or what kind of work they engage in. But this kind of a church certainly needs to take an inventory. The inventory should produce a list similar to the following: 250 women in the home, 210 men in business and industry, 15 men and women in the professions of law and medicine, 10 men and women teachers in the public and private education, 14 men working for the city, county, and state government. In addition to these, there might be 8 men and women serving on the boards of welfare organizations, 10 women are serving as volunteers in hospitals, 2 librarians, 3 are members of boards of education, 5 women working for the League of Women Voters, and so on. The weekday locations of these persons should be charted on a diagram showing where they are in the community in relation to the church where they worship, profess their faith, and receive their instruction. A chart of this weekly dispersion of church members, large enough to be easily seen, could be posted in the vestibule of the church, so that the members, when they arrive for worship from their place in the world, may have a vivid representation of an in-the-world image of themselves as they gather. The same diagram reminds them as they leave the church that they're still a church and that they're going where the church is meant to be and to serve both the Lord and his world. Such a diagram of the membership of the church that has joined the world suggests to them where their real work as Christians is. The members would be made conscious of their deployment in their community, whether rural, urban, or metropolitan, acquire a sense of being there in company with other churchmen, and develop an image of themselves as ambassadors of Christ, one through whom God makes his appeal. Two or even more local churches of different denominations might conceivably join together to represent their joint deployment into the same places in order that the two congregations might see that when they are the church in the world, they are not divided as they are when they gather as church in church. That is, a Lutheran and an Episcopal church might each have a diagram where each congregation coming and going might see a representation of their joint participation in the various institutions, organizations, and agencies of the community. They might even go a step farther and have joint sessions to prepare the members of these two churches representing different denominations for their training for the ministry in the world, thereby recognizing that there's no denominational difference in that aspect of their work. In this way, we would contribute to an ecumenical image of the church at work in the world. Something like this needs to be done to break up the rigidities of denominational identities and to create an identity of the church as the church in the world. As these in-the-world identities become known, provision should be made by the churches to form study groups that would help the members to understand their responsibilities in the world and to provide consultation for any individual or group who might want to work on special problems that occur in their respective ministries. It is unrealistic to organize Lenten study groups according to neighborhoods because the neighborhood does not provide a basis for either relationship or study. Rather, might groups be organized according to responsibilities in the world, businessmen, teachers, parents, board members, government workers, or any of the others. Again, why should such groups have to meet within a denomination? If the Christian's real concern is to serve the Lord and his world, there is no reason for denominational segregation in this aspect of our life. Actually, the cause of the church's ministry in the world would be enhanced by studying in groups mixed denominationally. Of course, the question is, do we want to give up our identities in favor of some true ones? More is needed, however, than study, since we are sent to work and act. Study should be aimed toward planned action as Christian participants in all human endeavors. A basic question that should inform study for Christian action is, what does it mean to work for Christ in the world? In order to answer this question, it is necessary for us to understand what Christ is doing. It is easy to choose our activity without reference to his purposes or functions. Or we may do the right thing for the wrong reasons or without benefit of full meaning. What is the work of Christ that will help us understand the meaning of the work that we do? His first work is in his creation. Today, his Spirit works in men to make known to them the nature, content, and process of the creation of which we are a part and in which we are participants. It follows then that any person employed in individual or corporate endeavors that explore the nature of our world and universe, reveals its mysteries and uses, or employs its energies for the benefit of man, may do this not only as a researcher or manufacturer, but as a Christian, one who in his work is a participant in the creation work of Christ. This is an example of the kind of correlations that need to be made between the meaning of human activity and God's activity. You know, this is a very exciting age in which to live. You read the newspaper of an account of the shot to the moon. What are we reading? We're reading how man has unraveled the mysteries that are buried in the story of creation. It's exciting. But instead, so much study of the gospel is separate from the meanings of life, with the result that it becomes mere subject matter. It is a rare church member that has made and employs such correlations. It is a teaching task of the church to make these correlations and to help its members have and grow in them. A year ago, I was having lunch with a scientist at a church conference, and he was engaged in some sort of experiments in measuring the speed of light. And I was asking him questions about it, and it was fascinating, even though I didn't understand it. And I said, "How does this tie in with your faith in God?" And he didn't even understand my question. All this is completely separate. And he understands God and Jesus Christ and the Holy Spirit and the world and the doctrine of man as something separate, separate subject matter altogether. There's no connections. This is tragic. The lack of these correlations is one reason why the church's life is so introspective and uncommitted to anything outside of itself. The making of these correlations between life and the gospel is essential, therefore, to the church's willingness and ability to engage in its true purpose or mission. Study groups, preparation for church membership, instructions of all kinds, and preaching must have these correlations as a part of their objective. Second, Christ's second work is in the maintaining of all that he made and redeemed. And as always, he works through all men in each generation to whom he made his unqualified gift of love. We may conclude, therefore, that all who are engaged in maintenance work, maintenance of roads, maintenance of buildings, organizations and agencies, and anything else, are Christ's servants in the maintenance of his great creation. Their work may therefore be an offering, an act of worship as well as service. Without this sense of offering from work, worship in church will be without content from the human side. These correlations between the meaning of the gospel and the meaning of life are necessary for true worship. Otherwise, we have nothing to offer, and therefore nothing with which to receive the gifts of forgiveness and grace. Those who go to the altar empty-handed will leave empty. Third, Christ's third work is the government of all things and relationships. Therefore, all those who are engaged in politics or participants in city, county, state, or federal government are also servants and agents of Christ in his governing purposes. These correlations also contribute to our sense of identity, which is dependent upon a growing sense and experience of relationship. A clerk in a city office, because of a feeble sense of identity, is a very average or inferior worker. But if he understands his life and his job with the city in the context of his Lord's governing purposes, he may be able to see himself as a worker for the kingdom of Christ as it is lived in the world. His achievement of this kind of identity, for example, affects the meanings and promises of his initiation in baptism when he was named, accepted as a person in his own right, and called to be a faithful soldier and servant of Christ and his church in the world. The church's study program should nurture this kind of identity that is based on and promotes responsible action. Christ's fourth work is to bring all that he has done and begun into fulfillment. And his people's task in the world is to assist in that fulfillment. What is the work that gives us an opportunity to share this task with him? Any work that calls people into being, that rescues them from destructive personal or environmental forces. Among these are educational and welfare work, therapies of all kinds, and research, to name three. A physician not only practices medicine, but shares in the healing work of Christ. Our task as a church is to affirm him, this physician, these physicians in their work, these educators. And if they cannot see and accept the full significance of what they are doing, we will have to see and accept it for them, with the hope that later they will accept it for themselves. Again, I say that study programs for Christian action must help the Christian find the meaning of his work in Christ's kingdom in the world. Other examples can be given of the kinds of correlations that we need to make if the church is to live in and serve the world with understanding. All human activity has some relation to God's activity, We must help each other find that relation and live it. The concept of the church that is emerging out of our discussion is that the church is a training school for ministry in the world. We touched on this briefly this morning. Now I'd like to develop it still further. Some people object to the word training because they associate it with the training of seals. But training is a part of education, and churchmen need training, which is education for a particular purpose. Every ministry that we receive, as for instance pastoral care, is a ministry that we must learn to pass on to others. To receive a ministry and not pass it on is to isolate the means of grace from the world. The agents of this ministry in the world are the laymen, and the clergy are their assistants. The work of making the correlations we have just discussed must be shared by the laity and clergy. Clergy cannot make them for the laity any more than a teacher can make the correlations for his students. But the laity cannot make them without the biblical and doctrinal assistance of the clergy. In all study and training programs, therefore, the laity must be active, not passive, participants. They must introduce from their lives and the work, the data, experiences, insights, and questions that provide a necessary polarity in the dialogue between life and the gospel. That's another matter. It's not easy in tidying. And yet many times clergy are very much upset because laity in the process of doing just what I've been recommended come upon times of very real doubt, and this disturbs the clergy. Without these, study sessions will deal only with theories and generalizations, and that's just the difficulty with too much Christian teaching. For example, a training seminar on the ministry of the church a training seminar on the ministry of church members engaged in labor relations requires that someone present a living flesh and blood representation of what actually happens to people and between people when they work out labor management agreements. The training session must be grounded in the facts of the situation, and all interpretations must be disciplined by the meaning of those facts. But the situation needs illumination and judgment of the presence of Christ. Out of this dialogue, laymen will discover their ministry, and clergy will come to recognize their role more clearly and their dependence upon the laity. The clergy must expect to learn from the laity as well as be their teachers. We clergy, therefore, must develop a ministry with rather than to people. And the same is true for the church, a ministry with rather than to the world, with the expectation that we will both teach and be taught. We need to invite partnership in ministry, and may do it by revealing ourselves more, by revealing that we do not have answers to many questions. Incidentally, many laity are more reassured by our admitting we don't know than by pretending that we do. By revealing that we too have questions as well as answers, doubts as well as belief, let us learn to minister out of our weakness to the strength of others, and out of strength to the weaknesses of men. It works both ways very well. Our training groups for ministry in the world need to use the relationships within the groups as a source of learning. The weaknesses of the church that we have described are in part a result of a failure to study the dynamics of relationship in which ministry occurs. Even as we discuss the importance of listening, for example, we may not be listening to each other. In this way is truth turned into impotent subject matter. I suggest first that our training groups provide opportunities for members to grow in self-understanding and in the understanding of others.
the naivete among so-called educated people today about human relations is almost past believing. And it seems to me that this is one of the areas in which the church might very well function, since it is sort of a specialty of the church. These understandings are not for life in the church, but for life in the world. Now, there's a great deal of sensitivity training going on, but I've discovered in talking with people who've attended it, that they think of this, again, as an in-church activity, as a resource for what goes on in meetings in the church. Now, this image is hard to break, and it's going to have to be blasted with some kind of dynamite, and by a persistence we have not yet begun to engage in. The world needs participants who understand themselves and who understand others, and who can function responsibly within those understandings. I suggest, second, that our training groups for ministry teach people to listen, to use their eyes and ears, and to teach them that the use of eyes and ears must precede the use of the mouth in order that they might know what to say and how to say it. Listening does not come naturally and has to be learned. Learning to see and hear is especially important for the church at this time in history, when talking about the gospel is no longer as effective as it used to be. I do not know where you are in relation to this, but I hope you can soon make your peace with this fact. Talking about the gospel in the terms of the gospel is not notoriously successful, even with church people. Listening to the world may teach us how to respond to the world out of the gospel, and I know of no other way. I suggest, third, that our training groups provide opportunities and resources for their members to learn to talk with each other, and later with others in the world, about the meaning of life and of work in relation to faith, without using the jargon. Having learned to talk with each other, they should learn to talk with strangers and those who have been estranged. The self-consciousness and ineptitude of church people in communication of their faith is one of the causes of the church's isolation from the world and its meaning. I suggest, fourth, that our training groups provide opportunity for members to learn to help each other in times of crisis, in order that as Christians in the world, they may be able to stand in the midst of crises helpfully rather than defensively. The meeting of emergencies and crises of various kinds with courage and resourcefulness instead of panic and flight is a powerful witness to the presence and the power of God. Alas, a moralistic and doctrinaire church fails to witness to that presence in that way. These learnings just mentioned are important also for church membership classes, which should include more training for ministry in the world and less indoctrination and preparation for denominational distinction and membership. If membership means joining the world, as I suggested this morning, training is needed for joining the world. Furthermore, training for membership should require that before a person is accepted for membership, he have determined what his Christian role is in the world and where he is to carry it out and how. When in the rite of admission, new members promise to follow Christ, Jesus Christ, they ought to know where and how they are going to do it. So many laymen have said to me, "I've made this promise, but nobody's told me where to do it or how to do it." A byproduct of this kind of relation of the church and the world would be the acquisition by the church of a feedback from the world, which, if studied, will be a source of learning and growth. A lack of feedback provision in the church's operation is one reason why the church's ministry has not grown with the growing up of the world, to use Bonhoeffer's concept. We must learn to study the results of what we say and do, learn from the response, and design new forms and procedures for ministry
instead of defensively justifying what we're doing in spite of the evidence that it isn't doing anything. Furthermore, the meanings people bring out of the world are the ones with which they will understand the gospel. An answer needs the question in order to be understood as answered. The gospel needs the world's question in order to be understood as the good news. Preaching and teaching, therefore, are the engagement of question and answer, and the preacher and teacher, ordained or lay, is the midwife in the dialogue between life and the gospel. The congregation is responsible for the church's preaching. The congregation, did you hear that? The congregation is responsible for the church's preaching because the dialogue between the gospel and life must take place in them. But they, in turn, are responsible for it occurring in the lives of others. If we will now return to figure 3, we will see that the movement between the church and world is two-way. As we move into the world, we take the meanings of our faith with us. We communicate these in our actions, decisions, and words about anything and everything. Our Christian meanings are addressed by persons, events, and situations in the world through which we believe God speaks to, judges, and illumines us. Out of this dialogue in the world, we move back into our centers for worship, renewal, and re-equipment for service. We take to our worship and instruction the questions, affirmations, frustrations, doubts, fears, beliefs, loves, hates that come out of our lives. And with these, and only with these, do we hear the gospel. The more we hear in church, the more we can do in the world. The more we live reflectively in the world, the more we will hear in church. The dialogue becomes cumulative, and the sense of power and blessing in both church and world becomes immense. No matter where we go, we are in responsible relation and open to God, who is always making all things new. This would make a good ending for these lectures, but you know you never end when you should. But there must be a postscript. There is one weakness in the scheme of things that I have outlined, and that is leadership. The leadership of the church is not designed for the development of this kind of ministry. The implications for theological education are searching. Working as I do, I find that most ministers, and I don't think I'm exaggerating here, and I see a very fine class of ministers, believe me, they're not the bottom of the pile by any manner of means. I find that most ministers have a clericalized conception of the ministry, and as representatives of the church are defensive in relation to the world. And they don't like being defensive. They are trained to give answers and are not open to questions. Indeed, they have not been trained to recognize the questions that people are asking. They're often asked not verbally, but non-verbally. They are even disturbed by questions, threatened by dialogue, unnerved by criticism, closed to feedback, uncomfortable in relation to the grown-up world. This is what they say of themselves. This is not my interpretation, and they don't like it. They're unhappy about it, and they resent having been trained in such a way that they turn out this way. They are made uneasy by educated, capable laymen. Of course, if this educated, capable layman was overcome by a heart attack, they would know what to do and feel more comfortable. We're afraid of the strong. We don't know what to do with the strong because we do not understand the needs of the strong.
And they do not know how to accept these strong people, but do not know how to train them for a ministry in which they could use their strength. I'm not bitter, and I'm not saying that our situation is entirely negative. Far from it. If that were the case, there'd be no point in saying any of this. I suggest, therefore, that seminaries and other agencies for training leaders examine their understandings of the relation between the church and the world, the nature of the ministry, the role of the laity, the responsibility of the clergy in relation to the laity, and the principle of communication that is implicit in all that they do, to see if they are really training leaders for today's rather than for yesterday's world. In relation to the world grown up, perhaps seminaries have some growing up to do too. I realize I'm saying this in a seminary, but I'm not thinking about this seminary only. As a matter of fact, I'm rather impressed with this seminary, to tell you the truth. I'm thinking about a lot of other places. I see a great many of them. If there had been a fifth lecture in this series, a third lecture in this series, it would have dealt with the implications of what I have said for theological education. And someday I'm going to write this. As a matter of fact, I've just accepted an invitation to work on this next winter. In order to meet the challenges to the church, it will be necessary for the present lay and ordained leaders of the church to seek and find resources for re-education and continuing education. And I think this is one of the reasons why, in this particular age, God has raised up a movement called continuing education that applies not only to clergy but to professional people everywhere. It is possible for us to train ourselves for the work we have to do if we will make studious use of some of the principles, for instance, that I have discussed. It is my hope that these two lectures have made some contribution to your continuing education. Now, I'd like to close these two lectures with a quotation from the book of Revelation. To the angel of the church at Sardis write, I know all your ways, that though you have a name for being alive, you are dead. Wake up and put some strength into what is left, which must otherwise die. For I have not found any work of yours completed in the eyes of my God. So remember the teaching you received. Observe it and repent.
People make shoes. I was reminded about the old, suddenly Joey Bishop is telling the old sermon illustration on the Jack Parr show some years ago. They go to a building project and the man asks the first bricklayer, what are you doing? He says, I'm making a living. Second one, what are you doing? And he says, I'm making money to take care of my family. And the third one says, I'm building a cathedral. And they said, so they fired him because they were building a garage. So this is pertinent to this point. You need leaders. Okay,
This is seminary plus the helpers of seminary people, I gather, as I look at this audience. And now your questions, both of this morning and this evening. I'll field them and Dr. Howe will catch them. What an interesting name for this man, the Howe. I think that's just wonderful. Thank you.
All right, Bob, you have done some work, as I understand it, in the field of theology and medicine. I wish you would comment on medical missions and the way you see these medical missions deriving and carrying out the work that you want.
What concerns the medical missions?
Well, I'm for them. I really don't know what your question is. Well, to practice medicine, to extend the healing ministry of the church, and to train people in ways of living that will keep them healthy, and training workers in countries, if they're backward, to help others to learn how to live and to take care of their bodies. It extends over into the preparation of food and mental hygiene. It's a great program. I'm sorry, I feel as if you expect more of me than I can produce. Well, this is an extension of the healing ministry of our Lord. And also, it seems to me that there is a very real correlation between our Lord's healing ministry and the research that is going on. We know one way of thinking about this is, for instance, in reading the creation story of Genesis, and then finally man was made, and he was given dominion over all things, and including himself. Well, now, medical research, for instance, is discovering for us what that really means, intensively, interiorly, and in terms of our relationships with other people, and what the potentialities are. And these marvelous things that they're doing, whereby they are building spare parts for parts of the body that have worn out, and so on. This is all, you know, this is God's creature that is studying God's creation and acquiring acquiring the dominion that God gave him to have. To me, this is the theological correlation. Now, I listened to a biological scientist, not long ago, give a lecture on this subject, and he said that we have come to the time when we will be expected to carry out to play God. They were his actual words, that we would be expected to play God. Well, I think this is an unfortunate, it was a thrilling lecture, but it ended theologically in a kind of a collapse. What I would rather have had him say, and I suggested this to him, but it wasn't dramatic enough for him, was that we're finally being called upon to exercise the dominion that God gave us in the first place. And this means that we're coming to the time when we're going to have to decide who is going to be born, who's going to be allowed to live. We're moving into an era that we're only beginning to get glimpses of. And the sense of responsibility that man is going to have to exercise in relation to life is way beyond anything we've ever dreamed of before, and it's going to call for correlations between our doctrine and our life that life has never demanded before. Now, maybe I'm doing a little better, maybe? Yeah, okay.
As you mentioned before, so often we don't listen because we can't listen. And if we can't listen, we're never going to get around to dialogue. How can we get past this first?
Well, what do you mean we can't listen?
Our backgrounds, our own presuppositions.
I don't think we need to be the prisoners of our backgrounds. I deplore this consequence of the psychological age.
You know, we sort of sit around and wait for somebody to make us want to do what we ought to do, and that day will never come. I think we can. For instance, do you play the piano? You do?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that isn't a good illustration. Do you play the violin? Okay. Well, you might say you can't play the violin because you've never played it. But if you were set up with a teacher and made to practice for a given number of times over a long period of time, the first thing you know, you'll be able to play the violin. Okay, you can learn to listen. That's kind of a bump, isn't it?
Very good.
Thank you.
I would say, sir, though, that after you sit in these chairs too long, you're a prisoner of your background, but that's enough. Right
from here, I saw a question. Please, Mr. Duco.
As you spoke, I was trying to think of ways to make the dialogue between the church and the world more concrete. Now, as you know, the German Evangelical Academies and other lay academies in Europe have been quite successful in fostering a dialogue between the church and the world. Do you think that such a program, a similar program, could be workable in the United States, such as the proposed Episcopal Lay Academy in Columbus, Ohio?
Yes, I think these things are a help, undoubtedly. I do feel that there's a better way of going at it. My experience leads me to believe that the clergy conference over here and the lay conference over here, in a way, only accentuates the separation between clergy and laity. And what I'm looking forward to is developing someday a program in which we will have training programs in which clergy and laity will be addressing each other and learn in relation and response to each other, since their ministry is a complementary ministry. Now, that these other things are first steps. I think the next step is to bring them together. That's my conviction. Have I made myself clear? You have a very quizzical look. Well, I think lay people in this country are suspicious of the church. They're suspicious that it doesn't mean anything. But it's quite possible to reach them. I make it a part of my business to search out people who are either estranged from the church or have not ever been a part of the church. And it's a fascinating thing to talk with them about their meanings. I mean, you don't pay any attention to your doctrine and your beliefs and so forth and so on. You leave them in the background. You hear with them, but you don't use them in this approach. And you ask them what they believe in. You ask them what means the most. You ask them about their commitments and what those commitments mean to them, how they get along in carrying them out. And the first thing you know, you're engaged in a conversation of meaning. You're dealing with, every man's a theologian, and the first thing you know, you're dealing with their ontological and theological questions. And the first thing you know, you begin to move in with some of the things that you do believe that make sense in relation to the sense they are voicing. And it's not uncommon for them to say, well, I never realized that this stuff had any meaning. But you see, they begin to understand it in terms of the questions they have, in terms of the beliefs that they have. And then the correlations begin to happen. This is one reason why the stance of the church must be dialogical, not monological. Now, is that...
Dr. Jasmine, please.
I wonder whether we could see now with what Dr. Howard's mentioning on, because we're concerned about the educational implications of this concept that the church is not only in the world, but with the world. This past week in Louisville, the professors of religious education and
this country were meeting for several days on models of Christian education. And we had all kinds of models. We can be sure, as we have here back there, that your model does not allow for the usual kind of model that's in the Missouri Synod, because the catechetical model does not call for what we are talking of as intersection or interaction or dialogue or whatever terms you want to use, engagement, involvement, and so on. We're sure that the model of the psychological development of the individual isn't adequate because of the social concerns that you've been talking about. Now, would you elaborate a little more on what some other obvious educational applications of your principles would readily be made on the basis of the principles you established? Because I think this is where we've got to start if the church is to change. And then see that this is also applicable on all levels of education, not just on this adult level, where most people probably would think that we ought to stay.
I don't have the same difficulties with the catechetical method that you cite. Because it seems to me the catechetical method is basically dialogical. Now, we have a catechism in the Episcopal Church, and I, on many occasions, have used the questions but left the people free to state their answers rather than just reciting the answers that come with the catechism. And then after a while, they begin to understand this, because you have to have some latitude in the use of any form, or the form will become your prisoner. It would, but then you can begin to change that too, you see. And indeed, as you begin to cope with the responses you get, you find that you're having to restate the question, you see. And so that you don't need to worry about that. And the first thing you know, you have such a limber catechism, it's a delight to use.